Clive Stafford Smith will not be with us today. We hope in the coming days, talking about Binyam Mohamed, just released in Britain from Guantanamo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, what's going on? It's DJ Ev along with
Mrs. Chester
with your WUSB concert billboard for Tuesday, February 24th.
Three Doors Down is at the Hammerstein Ballroom. Tom Jones, 8:30 p.m. at Terminal 5. Casey Mojo doing the Mardi Gras thing, 8 p.m. Once and for All, Hatchog. Reckoning at 10:30, Lulu's Village Pub, Port Jefferson.
And looking ahead to Wednesday, February 25th, at Sullivan Hall, 8:30 doors, Krantz, Carlock, Lefebvre, with special guest Trevor Exeter. And in Smithtown at the Overtime Sports Bar at 9 p.m., it's Jim Moran and Pam Betty. Off City Limits is at Hofstra University in Hempstead at 7:30. And at McGuire's Comedy Club at 8, it's Motu and the Roadhouse Jesters. And in New York City at Webster Hall, it's Tokyo Police Club. Tapes and Tapes are at the Bowery Ballroom. If you've got a gig that you want listed on the concert billboard, send an email to Scene. That's S-C-E-N-E at WUSB.FM. And as always, thanks for listening to the concert billboard on WUSB in Stony Brook.
Where it's 2 minutes after 6 o'clock, time once again for Off the Wall. I think the new theme's working out rather nicely. Not quite sure where to come in yet, but we'll work that out. And we've added a bunch of post-theme stuff, so it's not too short. So I've got, like this. I've got something else to talk over, which is kind of cool. It's nice. We're moving into a new stage here at the radio show, and feels good. Feels natural. So welcome. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on another edition of Off the Wall. This are last show of February. Can't believe it. It's going so fast. Really is. We're just catapulting through this year, aren't we? Almost to spring, and I just wish there was a little bit more winter to come. Well, all right, we have a bunch of things to discuss tonight. Maybe we'll take some phone calls, although I gotta say, you know, the response last week, we had one phone call, and that was it. And we need more than that if we're gonna take phone calls. As you know, it's a lot of trouble to get into phone taking mode. So we'll see, I suppose. Well, here's some good news. Some good news to start off with. Intelligent civilizations are out there. Yes, if you've been looking for some and haven't found any locally, they are out there somewhere. There could be thousands of them. That's according to an Edinburgh scientist who fancies himself an expert. The discovery of more than 330 planets outside our solar system in recent years has helped refine the number of life forms that are likely to exist. I love when we try and wrap our heads around what's actually out there. You know, when you look up at the sky and you see all these incredible signs of other worlds, it's like every day we're told how insignificant we are just by looking up. Some of us by looking down, but if you look up, you basically see every single one of those little tiny lights is a sun, most of which are bigger than our own. And for us to even assume, for however many years we assume, that we were the only planet that existed, the only planet that harbored life, how insane was that? So now, okay, we're finally opening up our minds to the possibility, or maybe now certainty, that there are, in fact, other planets that harbor life out there. And 330 is the number that we currently have managed to accept. Go out tonight, assuming it's not cloudy like it is here, and just look at that sky and tell me there are only 330 planets out there that sustain intelligent life. If you said 330 billion, I don't think that you begin to touch the surface. And that just blows me away that there is so much out there. And it just shows how much further we have to go. So those of you who ever think that the journey is at an end or that we can't do any more, just look up at the sky and you'll see what's out there, what the potential is and how much we have yet to learn. Because we first have to learn how to get there. Wouldn't it be the ultimate irony if, as if to mock us, the sky simply looked down on us century after century and we were never able to reach it? We were never able to get there. And people once thought that about the ocean, that we could never cross the ocean. It was just there as this barrier that forever prevented us from moving beyond our own little locale. Well, we always bridge these gaps one way or another, and a little thing like the speed of light is not going to stop us. All right, let me get back to this story here. 330 planets. Okay, well, the current research estimates that there are at least 361 intelligent civilizations in our galaxy, and possibly as many as 38,000. Possibly, though. Yeah, not sure yet. This work is reported in the International Journal of Astrobiology, and even with the higher of the two estimates, it's not very likely that contact could be established with alien worlds. Not sure what that means exactly. Are they saying ever or now? Obviously, not now, at least not in a way that we know about, but how can you say something is impossible forever? While researchers often come up with overall estimates of the likelihood of intelligent life in the universe, it's a process fraught with guesswork, and recent guesses put the number anywhere between a million and less than one. Yeah, likelihood of intelligent life in the universe, less than one. It's a process of quantifying our ignorance, said Duncan Forgan, the University of Edinburgh researcher who carried out the work. In his new approach, Mr. Forgan simulated a galaxy much like our own, allowing it to develop solar systems based on what is now known from the existence of so-called exoplanets in our galactic neighborhood. He simulated a galaxy. He played God. That's right. You know, I always ask the religious people, God, you know, this whole Bible thing and creating the Earth 7 days, what about the rest of the universe? How is he tie into that exactly? Are there other gods? Is there a Saturn god? And I know Saturn is named after But the point is there a God for every single planet, every single solar system, perhaps? Galaxy? What? How? Where does God's jurisdiction end? I just want an answer to that. If I want to do something and not be touched by God or punished by him, her, whatever, in the future, how far do I have to travel? Now, you know, I can answer that question anywhere on Earth. I can always figure out where to go to get outside the boundaries of a particular law enforcement agency. And basically, God is pretty much the ultimate law enforcement agency. So, just like to know. And, you know, is it right to call him God, her God? You know, I can't say him or her every single time. I'm just going to say him as a default. Is it right to use the word God? Because isn't God the way you describe the entity, not the name? It's like something stupid like calling the moon, or the sun, you know? We just don't do things like that. All right, getting back to the story here. These simulated alien worlds were then subjected to a number of different scenarios. The first assumed that it is difficult for life to be formed, but easy for it to evolve, and suggested there are 361 intelligent civilizations in the galaxy. A second scenario assumed life was easily formed, but struggled to develop intelligence. Under these conditions, 31,513 other forms of life were estimated to exist. The final scenario examined the possibility that life could be passed from one planet to another during asteroid collisions, a popular theory for how life arose here on Earth, and also a popular theory for every science fiction show ever made because it explains why we all look the same. And that approach gave a result of some 37,964 intelligent civilizations in existence. Now, while far-flung planets may reduce uncertainty in how many Earth-like planets there are, some variables in the estimate will remain guesses. For example, the time from a planet's formation to the first sparks of life, or from there to the first intelligent civilizations, are large variables in the overall estimate. And for those, Mr. Forgan says, we'll have to continue to assume Earth is an average case. I can buy that. It is important to realize that the picture we've built up is still incomplete, he says. Even if alien life forms do exist, we may not necessarily be able to make contact with them, and we have no idea what form they would take. Life on other planets may be as varied as life on Earth, and we cannot predict what intelligent life on other planets would look like or how they might behave. They could be very, very bad. And they could look like giant squid. Think about that. Or they could be microscopic. Anything. Anything is possible. And that's what drives everybody crazy. Let's look at some predictions. Let's look at some predictions for what life will be like in 100 years. Isn't that wonderful to look into the future and just kind of imagine how different things might be? And then if you're lucky, you can check in 100 years and see just how right you are. Well, it's not likely very many of us will be able to do that, but what we can do is go back in time, where some poor schmuck has predicted what life is going to be like in 100 years, and then see if they were right. And thanks to the Ladies' Home Journal of 1900, we're able to do just that. December 1900. Yeah, we're even looking back to 100 years from then, because it's now 2009, and we're looking back at the year 2000. And we all know things have changed so dramatically since 2000. The Ladies' Home Journal from December 1900, is that still published? I think it is. It contained a fascinating article by John F. Elfrith. That's a fascinating name right there. I can't say that. No wonder they stopped using it. Let's just say John Watkins Jr. That's a nice, simple name. What may happen in the next 100 years? He wrote, these prophecies will seem strange, almost impossible. Yet, they have come from the most learned and conservative minds in America. Learned and conservative. Wow, they used to mean the same thing. To the wisest and most careful men in our greatest wisest and most careful? Why do wise people have to be careful? I would think wise people would be more carefree. You know, throwing caution to the wind and all that. That's how you find out what way the wind is blowing. Our greatest institutions of science and learning, okay, let me finish that sentence again, or start that sentence. To the wisest men and most careful men in our greatest institutions of science and learning, I have gone, asking each in his turn to forecast for me what, in his opinion, will have been wrought in his own field of investigation before the dawn of 2001, a century from now. These opinions I have carefully transcribed. Is it me, or is he talking backwards? He's talking like Yoda. Is that how people used to talk back then? Anyway, let us now look at some of the predictions. We have a bunch here. We'll pick a few out at random. There will probably be from 350 million to 500 million people in America and its possessions by the lapse of another century. Nicaragua will ask for admission to our union after the completion of the Great Canal. Mexico will be next. Europe, seeking more territory to the south of us, will cause many of the South and Central American republics to be voted into the Union by their own people. Well, you're kind of right about the population. That's about it. I think all those countries, the last thing they want to do is join the United States. The American will be taller by from 1 to 2 inches. His increase of stature will result from better health due to vast reforms in medicine, sanitation, food, and athletics. He will live 50 years instead of 35. Wow. Did we really only live 35 years in 1900? My God. Okay, he'll live 50 years instead of 35 as at present, for he will reside in the suburbs. Yes, that's right, folks. The suburbs are what's keeping you alive. I know those are words of dismay to many people, but it's true. The city house will practically be no more. Building in blocks will be illegal. I don't know what that means, building in blocks. Like toy blocks or city blocks. Not quite sure what they meant by that. The trip from suburban home to office will require a few minutes only, and a penny will pay the fare. Well, if a penny is the equivalent of $10, then I guess that's true. Gymnastics will begin in the nursery, where toys and games will be designed to strengthen the muscles. Exercise will be compulsory in the schools. Every school, college, and community will have a complete gymnasium. All cities will have public gymnasiums. A man or a woman unable to walk 10 miles at a stretch will be regarded as a weakling. Well, then, 10 miles at a stretch? When have any of us walked 10 miles at a stretch? That's like walking from here to, what, King's Park or something? Which I know nobody listening outside the area knows, but that's pretty far. And I don't think anybody would want to do that. It would take the whole day. There will be no streetcars in our large cities. All hurry traffic will be below or high above ground when brought within city limits. In most cities, it will be confined to broad subways or tunnels, well-lighted and well-ventilated, or to high trestles with moving sidewalk stairways leading to the top. Moving sidewalks. You see, even back then, they wanted moving sidewalks. These underground or overhead streets will teem with capacious automobile passenger coaches and freight with cushioned wheels. Subways or trestles will be reserved for express trains. Cities, therefore, will be free from all noises. Oh, you couldn't have been more wrong on that. But it's a nice idea. Trains will run 2 miles a minute. 2 miles a minute. So that's about 120 miles an hour. Well, you got that right for Europe. Don't have that right for here. Not yet, anyway. Maybe after 8 years of Obama, maybe we'll get 120 mile an hour trains everywhere. Normally, express trains, 150 miles an hour. To go from New York to San Francisco will take a day and a night by fast express. Oh, if only. That would be so cool. Takes about a week now. And not by express either. There will be cigar-shaped electric locomotives hauling long trains of cars. Cars will, like houses, be artificially cooled. Along the railroads, there will be no smoke, no cinders, because coal will neither be carried nor burned. There will be no stops for water. Passengers will travel through hot or dusty country regions with windows down. Oh, I love this. Automobiles will be cheaper than horses are today. I actually, what do horses go for today? I don't know. Never tried to buy one. Farmers will own automobile hay wagons, automobile truck wagons, plows, harrows, and hay rakes. A one-pound motor in one of these vehicles will do the work of a pair of horses or more. Children will ride in automobile sleighs in winter. Automobiles will have been substituted for every horse vehicle now known. There will be, as already exists today, automobile hearses, automobile police patrols, automobile ambulances, automobile street sweepers. The horse in harness will be as scarce, if indeed not even scarcer, than as the yoked ox is today. And as we all know, the yoked ox is back in favor, so you see those everywhere. I did see those in North Korea. Here's another prediction from the year 1900 as to what life will be like in 2000. There will be airships, but they will not successfully compete with surface cars and water vessels for passenger or freight traffic. Okay, you're pretty wrong on that one, too. They will be maintained as deadly war vessels by all military nations. Okay. Some will transport men and goods. Others will be used by scientists, making observations at great heights above the Earth. All right. Aerial warships and forts on wheels. Giant guns will shoot 25 miles or more and will hurl anywhere within such a radius, shells exploding and destroying whole cities. Such guns will be armed by aid of compasses when used on land or sea and telescopes when directed from great heights. Fleets of airships hiding themselves with dense smoky mists thrown off by themselves as they move will float over cities, fortifications, camps, or fleets. They will... Thank you, person messaging me, and I forgot to turn my my phone to vibrate. Hang on, let me just do that right now so this doesn't happen yet again. Okay, I'm in meeting mode now. Yes, where was I? Thrown off themselves as they move, will flood over cities, fortifications, camps, or fleets. They will surprise foes below by hurling upon them deadly thunderbolts. These aerial warships will necessitate bomb-proof forts protected by great steel plates over their tops as well as their sides. Huge forts on wheels will dash across open spaces at the speed of express trains today. They will make what are now known as cavalry charges. Whoever did this put a lot of thought into it. It's either a military person or a child. Great automobile plows will dig deep entrenchments as well as soldiers, rather as fast as soldiers can occupy them. Rifles will use silent cartridges. Submarine boats submerged for days will be capable of wiping a whole navy off the face of the deep. Balloons and flying machines will carry telescopes of 100-mile vision with camera attachments, photographing an enemy within that radius. These photographs, as distinct and large as if taken from across the street, will be lowered to the commanding officer in charge of troops below. Maybe a little preview of satellite imagery there, and nuclear war and things like that, without actually knowing that what was being predicted. Here's another prediction. Photographs will be telegraphed from any distance. If there be a battle in China 100 years hence, snapshots of its most striking events will be published in the newspapers an hour later. Even today, photographs are being telegraphed over short distances. Photographs will reproduce all of nature's colors. Wow. Makes sense. I mean, back then, they only had black and white. But they knew they were going to get color at some point. They knew it. And finally, this is the last prediction we'll read today. Man will see around the world. Persons and things of all kinds, will be brought within focus of cameras connected electrically with screens at opposite ends of circuits, thousands of miles at a span. American audiences in their theaters will view upon huge curtains before them the coronations of kings in Europe or the progress of battles in the Orient. They predicted CNN. The instrument bringing these distant scenes to the very doors of people will be connected with a giant telephone apparatus, transmitting each incidental sound in an appropriate place, in its appropriate place. Thus, the guns of a distant battle will be heard to boom when seen to blaze. And thus, the lips of a remote actor or singer will be heard to utter words or music when seen to move. When seen to move. I just love that right there. Predictions from the Ladies' Home Journal from the year 1900, of what it would be like in the year 2000. Write to us, otw@2600.com. Maybe we'll read some more of those or find some other predictions that other people have made. Always a lot of fun to check those things out. Well, tonight we have an interesting event. Barack Obama is giving the equivalent of the State of the Union address. It's not the State of the Union because he's a new president, so new presidents don't give the State of the Union, and that always takes place in January anyway, and it's now February. But what they do is give a joint address, or an address rather to the joint houses of Congress. And you know, he has to be invited into Congress. He's not allowed to walk in. He has to be officially invited. So tonight, I think starting at 9 o'clock, he's going to give his assessment of the future and what he's doing and things like that. It'll have a heavy emphasis on the economy, and we'll try to strike an optimistic tone, according to aides. Yeah, what about that economy? I don't know what the stock market did today. I think it went up. I don't know why I know these things, but yesterday it was at 1997 levels. 1997. Of course, I don't know what that means exactly. I'm not quite sure how that affects anyone but stockbrokers. But it does. I mean, we do see the effects around us, people losing their jobs, people losing their homes. Just not sure that the difference between the stock market on Friday and the stock market on Monday really matters to many people. But it is interesting that it's to a 1997 level now. Anyway, basically, Obama believes he will meet these challenges and lift ourselves out of this recession, said one top aide. He will say the best days are ahead of us. Well, you always have to say that, don't you? Can you imagine if you said the opposite, that the best days are behind us? Wouldn't go over very well. Even if it's not true, you have to say that. This speech is going to run about 60 minutes. It'll touch lightly on foreign policy so the president can focus largely on the economy and related issues, including health care, education, and energy. The address will be thematic and won't get into much detail on Obama's plans to deal with the credit crunch and housing crisis. The broad theme will be that the country needs to look forward to solve the financial crisis. Now, how much midnight oil did they have to burn to come up with that gem? Yeah, we need to look forward in order to get through a crisis. What crisis has ever been solved by looking behind you? I mean, you're not going to kill an hour just expressing that sentiment. You know, here's something interesting. Attorney General Eric Holder will not attend Obama's speech. He refuses to attend Obama's speech. He will not set foot in the same room that Barack Obama is in. Yeah, that's true. It's all true. Trouble in paradise? Not really. Not really. You know what this is? This is something that I knew about peripherally, but now I know about it a little bit more. And that's this this concept of the designated survivor. The designated survivor. Now, think about it. And those of you who watch 24 would know about this. When you have the president addressing both houses of Congress, all the senators, all the representatives, well, gee, wouldn't that be a terrific place for a terrorist to plant some sort of confusing device that would take out everybody at once? Then you'd be in disarray. There'd be no leadership. But the designated survivor allows for something like that to be taken care of. Now, the designated survivor, or successor, sometimes they're called, is a member of the United States cabinet who stays at a physically distant, secure, and undisclosed location. Well, he's downstairs, by the way. I passed him on the way. I don't mean to blow it, but I mean, I saw him downstairs in the cafeteria, or somebody who looks a lot like Eric Holder. Now, Stony Brook is far away from Washington, D.C., I realize, and it's pretty distant and secure, and until now, undisclosed. But, yeah, you know, no secrets around here. So basically, they send that person away when the president and the country's other top leaders are gathered at a single location, like during the State of the Union address or presidential inaugurations. Now, this maintains continuity of government with regards to presidential succession and a remote possibility of a catastrophic event, which might wipe out large portions of the United States' federal government, including the entire slate of individuals designated by law in the line of succession to the presidency. And since U.S. law does not provide for anyone to assume the office of president if everyone on this list is simultaneously killed, the practice of designating a survivor is intended to effectively eliminate the chance of that happening. It originated during the Cold War amid fears of a nuclear attack. Now, only cabinet members who are eligible to succeed to the presidency, like natural-born citizens, can be chosen as designated survivors. So today's designated survivor is Eric Holder. So that means if everything blows up tonight, he's going to be our leader. Think about that. Now, who are previous leaders, previous potential leaders? Well, there's a whole bunch. Thanks to Wikipedia, there's a big list here. During the presidential inauguration, it was Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense, Republican. Yeah. He was the designated survivor. During the 2008 State of the Union, it was Dirk Kempthorne, Secretary of the Interior. And get this, during both the 2005 and 2006 State of the Union, it was Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska. I think the real reason was they wouldn't let him in. But yeah, that's something. That's something to realize. Now, Eric Holder, interesting person, current Attorney General. What he said last week was rather interesting. Did you catch this? In a blunt assessment of race relations in the United States, Attorney General Eric Holder last Wednesday called the American people essentially a nation of cowards in failing to openly discuss the issue of race. That's right, yeah. In his first major speech since being confirmed, the nation's first black attorney general told an overflow crowd celebrating Black History Month, at the Justice Department, the nation remains voluntarily socially segregated. Though this nation has proudly thought of itself as an ethnic melting pot, in things racial, we have always been and continue to be, in many ways, essentially a nation of cowards. He urged Americans of all races to use Black History Month as a time to have a forthright national conversation between blacks and whites to discuss aspects of race which are ignored because they are uncomfortable. Well, I applaud that kind of honesty in expressing one's opinions. And I know a lot of people have expressed dismay. But if you're expressing your own opinions, then how can that be a bad thing? It opens up the debate. It opens up the discussion. And talking about things is always constructive, as long as it's in a constructive mode. So with that spirit, we launch into the topic of the stimulus monkey. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. The cartoon in the New York Post. I think we've all seen it by now. Do I have to go over this again? The cartoon was basically showing two cops over the corpse of a monkey who had been shot by them. And they say they'll have to find someone else to write the next stimulus bill. Now, of course, this has led to all kinds of consternation. The Reverend Al Sharpton has denounced it. Some cartoonists and commentators have lambasted it as racist. Other commentators have declared that it's just a bad cartoon, but one lacking an ugly intent. And its editor has defended it. Yeah. So the NAACP has called for the firing of the New York Post cartoonist. On Saturday, they spoke at the Civil Rights annual meeting in New York. President Benjamin Todd Jealous. Oh, my God, that's his name? Jealous? His last name is Jealous? How does anybody survive with a name like that? Jealous. I didn't know that could be a last name. Wow. Anyway, Jealous said that it's very hard to say that. If Sean Delonis, that's the cartoonist, is not fired, the group will call for protests of the paper and Fox Television affiliates, which are owned by Post parent company News Corporation. There is consensus that if the Post does not get rid of the journalists who are responsible for this bit of hate speech, seeing the light of day, that we will move this from a local regional issue to a very national issue. They also called for the cartoonist editor to be fired. Now, many critics said the cartoon played on historically racist images by appearing to compare Obama, the nation's first black president, to a chimpanzee that had been shot by police officials, officers rather. The cartoon references the mauling of a Connecticut woman by a chimpanzee who was later shot and killed by police. That right there is a crazy story. Chimp went berserk. Apparently this chimp had been hanging out with this woman for years, drinking champagne with her and hanging out in hot tubs or whatever. It was kind of a bizarre relationship. And one day the chimp just had enough and went crazy and started mauling a friend of hers. And cops came and did what they do best. They shot and killed it. I think they sort of had to, though. He was going nuts. Anyway, so that led to this cartoon coming out. Now, when I looked at this cartoon, I honestly didn't get it at all. And I completely understand why people would be offended by this, because there aren't very many interpretations that you can draw from it. You look at this thing and you see, you know, a dead monkey on the ground and two white cops saying, well, they'll have to find someone else to write the next stimulus bill. And of course, even though Obama didn't write the stimulus bill, it was technically written by Congress, his name is all over it. So it's not a far reach to think that they're referring to Obama. It really isn't. And then you add into that the historical context to this. And a lot of people have trouble appreciating this. I realize this. A lot of people have trouble. They say that George W. Bush was compared to a monkey. Nobody complained about that. And it's a fair point. How come it's okay to call one person something, but not another person? Not even to imply that another person is something. And for that, you have to go back into history. You have to go back into time and just look at how things played out. You look at the images of black people as monkeys, as apes, as ignorant, as the myth of being lazy, shuffling feet, eating watermelon and fried chicken, having wildly distorted features and bulging eyes and things like that. You look at that in context with the racial disgrace that's taking place in this country that Eric Holder, I'm sure, is referring to. And you can sort of understand, if you think about it for a few minutes, why those images, when related to people who have a link to that past, might be a bit more offensive than they would be to those who don't have that link. And you can point to all kinds of other ethnic groups and nationalities across the world where there are certain words, certain phrases, certain pictures and images that draw reaction. But don't draw reaction for somebody else. And that's why, you know, if you want to try and be civilized, you don't rub salt in the wound and bring up bad memories or bad historical references that are pretty much designed to elicit a response. Now, to put it into a context that maybe we can understand a little better, let's think of something that a person like George W. Bush, who, yes, was represented as a monkey many times, because, yes, you can call people monkeys and make fun of them. You know, a monkey could do that. The various things that you say with completely non-racial meanings to it. But let's think of something that would be offensive to a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant in this country. Something that, when you hear it, is just so offensive that you can say it to other races, you can say it to other people, other colors. But if you say it to them, it rubs salt in the wound. Like I said, it makes people very upset. It brings back bad memories. It makes you realize how bad things were in the past and how misjudged and oppressed you once were. And you know what? I can't think of a single thing. I can't think of a single image, a single phrase, a single reference that, when applied to that particular group of people, would elicit the same response or even a similar response. Because they have never felt it. They've never felt that kind of fear, oppression, prejudice, hatred. They've never felt it. So how can they possibly understand what it feels like? And if I'm wrong, if there is some way of really offending people that have had the advantage pretty much throughout in this country, share it. I'd like to know. Now, all that said, I think some of the protests have gone a bit far, and I think it's wrong to harp on this for too long, because ignorant people should not be focused upon for longer than they deserve. And neither should bad cartoonists. Now, it's either one or the other, all right? There's no way this is a good cartoon. I'm sorry. There's nothing funny about it. I don't know what they're referring to. They just basically took something in the news. They took a chimpanzee that had been shot by cops and made some reference to the stimulus package, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, if somebody explained it, and someone tried to explain this to me for about 10 minutes, and I said, okay, I guess I could sort of see where they're trying to say that if there was a single author of the stimulus bill, that they did a very bad job of it and therefore were a monkey, so it means that they're going to have to find somebody to write the next one because they just shot that one. I guess that's sort of, but surely you must see how it could be seen in a different way. Surely you must see that. It's hard not to. So, yeah, I mean, it's obvious that it was in the back of people's minds, and the plausible deniability was always forefront in their minds. All right, all that said, the point has been made. We should move on. Not call for the FCC to revoke licenses of TV stations that had nothing to do with this. Not call for the government to get involved. Imagine if every single time somebody said something that was controversial or even downright nasty, that we called in the government to deal with them. No, let's deal with them ourselves. Deal with them in various boycott the post if you must. And I've been doing that successfully for many years now. Don't patronize people who are stupid. Well, patronize them in one way. Don't patronize them in another way. It just, I think it has a backlash when you insist on all kinds of penalties, when in actuality, just having it see the light of day is penalty enough. And it would be nice. I mean, I do respect Al Sharpton, but it would be nice if somebody else stepped up to object when something like this happens, because he just brings forth a reaction in a lot of people that is instantaneously negative. And that goes all the way back to the Tawana Brawley thing. I hear she's making a comeback, by the way. So, we'll be not. There are other people there that can lead protest and speak up and say intelligent things. And again, he does say intelligent things. It's just he has a lot of negative baggage that comes with him. He's actually saying that the NAACP is going too far. He said firing them and not dealing with the overall problems of who's in the newsroom doesn't address what he termed the unfair setup of staffing. Anyway, so it's good to talk about this kind of thing. It's bad to fixate on it. It's bad to dig yourself in and refuse to listen. And I see that on a lot of different sides. In this particular case, I think it's time to take the high road and say, okay, these people are idiots. Let's move on. As we will do right now. Move on to another story, which is one of my favorites. The Iraqi shoe thrower. Yes. Do you know he's still in prison? That's insane. That should not be happening. The guy that threw a couple of shoes, they weren't even very hard shoes, threw a couple of shoes at George W. Bush when he was in Iraq. His name is Muntada al-Zadi, the Iraqi journalist. He said the former American leader's bloodless and soulless smile and his joking banter provoked him. He threw both of his shoes at Bush during a December news conference with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in Baghdad, that is. Neither shoe hit the president. Well, they would have if he hadn't moved. It was a pretty good shot. Other people in the room quickly knocked al-Zadi to the ground before security officials arrested him. He explained his actions in an hour-long appearance on Thursday at the Central Criminal Court of Iraq, asked if anyone pushed or motivated him to do this. He said he was spurred on by the violations that are committed against the Iraqi people. I could only see Bush and feel the blood of the innocents flow under his feet as he was smiling that smile, as if he had come to bid farewell to Iraq and with the last support and more than 1 million martyrs. At that moment, I felt this is the man who killed our nation, the main murderer, and the main person responsible for killing our nation. Speaking in his first public appearance since his arrest 2 months ago, he told the court he got emotional and threw the shoe at him. The second one was involuntary. I had no intention to kill the commander of the occupying forces, even if I had a weapon. I was expressing my inner feelings and those of all the Iraqi people from east to west and north to south and the feelings of hatred they hold for him. He told the judge that he had intended to humiliate Bush in the past, as Bush listed the gains made in Iraq during the mid-December news conference. Al-Zaidi said he was thinking about the millions of civilians who had been killed, widowed, or displaced. He talked about the sanctity of mosques being violated, the rape of women, and daily humiliations. I don't know what accomplishments he was talking about. The accomplishments I could see were the more than 1 million martyrs and a sea of blood. He said there were more than 5 million Iraqi orphans because of the occupation, more than 1 million widows, and more than 3 million displaced because of the occupation. He also said he was beaten up in front of the prime minister and the world when he was taken from the room where the press conference was held. The trial will resume March 12th when the court asks the cabinet to clarify whether Bush's visit was official or not. The official charge is assaulting a foreign head of state on an official visit to Iraq. So if it wasn't an official visit, then that charge doesn't stand. Let's hope he gets off on that. But really, the guy obviously didn't mean to cause injury and to make a statement and humiliation. Think about it. I mean, right here at Stony Brook, long time ago, one of my first memories, actually, of Stony Brook, when I first came here, we were dedicating for, there was a dedication for this structure called the Bridge to Nowhere. And they had finally opened it and made it go somewhere. They built the library backwards and they couldn't go there, so it went someplace else. They made it make a left turn and it looked kind of ridiculous. But there was a big opening ceremony and the university president, whose name was John Toll, was giving a speech. And I think it was all broadcast live here on WUSB. And some mischief maker, in fact, I know who it was, went up to John Toll and threw a pie in his face. And that was the big thing back then. That used to be the big thing, especially in the 70s. Leaders would get pied. In fact, there's a guy named Pie Man who lives in New York City who was famous for this. And yeah, you know, maybe they got arrested and held overnight for throwing a pie at somebody. And it was annoying and embarrassing to the person who got pied. But it's just one of those things. It was an extreme way of making a statement. But nobody really got hurt. And you didn't have to hold somebody in prison for months or threaten them with life in prison for assaulting a world leader. Those are different times. So, you know, people don't get pied anymore either. I've noticed that. If there was suddenly a pieing campaign that started, you know, if people started to get pied left and right, you know, leaders, people like that, mayors and governors and presidents, I wonder what the reaction would be. I wonder if people would realize that, hey, we've done this before. Or if it would be seen as the newest threat from Al-Qaeda. Yeah, they're using baked goods against us. I don't know. I think we need to move back into those simpler times where not everything was a huge, major threat. Of course, I don't know what would happen back then if somebody threw a shoe. I don't think we could have dealt with that because that was completely alien to us back then. Interesting summer ahead. British police have warned that officers are preparing for a summer of rage as protests mount across Europe against the economic crisis. Yeah, that's right. They have protests over there against the economy. We just bemoan our fate and look at the stock market every day. But over there, you know, in Madrid and Athens and Paris and London, they actually take to the streets. I'm not quite sure what they expect to change immediately, except to really express their frustration, which is always a good thing, whether it's by throwing pies or by having a protest or just speaking out against something you think is unfair. David Hartshorn, who heads the Metropolitan Police's Public Order Branch, yes, Public Order Branch, said growing unemployment, failing companies, and the recession could spark a mass protest. And if it wasn't about to, he's given a lot of people an idea. Until now, Superintendent Hartshorn said there were insufficient numbers of activists to carry out large-scale demonstrations. But he told London's Guardian, obviously, not a person who's London's Guardian, a newspaper called the Guardian, obviously the downturn in the economy, unemployment, repossessions, all of that changes everything. Suddenly, there is the opportunity for people to mass protest. He said April's G20 economic summit, that's going to be a lot of fun. The G20 summit taking place over there. It could lead to unrest as leaders of the world's richest nations head to London. We've got G20 coming, and I think that is being advertised on some of the sites as the highlight of what they see as a summer of rage. Of course, you do realize, Superintendent Hartshorn, that April's not in the summer. It can't really be the highlight of the summer when the summer hasn't even begun yet. So maybe a prelude to summer is what you meant to say. Huh? How about that? The officer added that protesters may target banks, especially those still paying large bonuses despite receiving state aid. You know, it sounds like this guy is almost an activist himself, kind of warning people to, to behave because they're going to be targets of angry citizens. They're doing things like paying bonuses when they're receiving all this money from the population. Makes perfect sense. Protests sparked by the economic crisis have taken place recently in several cities across Europe. More than 100,000 people marched in Dublin on Saturday. Did you hear about this? 100,000 people in Dublin. I bet you don't think there are 100,000 people in Dublin. Well, there are. A lot more. But it wasn't in the media, was it? They marched on Saturday over the Irish government's handling of the recession. Similar large demonstrations have also broken out in France, Greece, Russia, and Iceland. That's right, Iceland. They were one of the first, in fact. Now, if you can get a lot of people together on the streets in Iceland in the middle of the winter, and yes, they do have the same winter as us, I think that says something when we stay inside. And there's certainly a lot to protest about. Despite his British Jobs for British Workers pledge at the Labour Party conference in 2007, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown described unofficial strikes at oil refineries and power stations as counterproductive. They're striking, saying that they don't want foreign workers to be used. Yeah, so I mean, this is kind of the ugly side of it, too, when people start protesting against other people who are equally victimized. Speaking from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Brown said he understood why people were worried. They look around and say, well, why can't we do these jobs ourselves? However, he said instead of spontaneous strike action, what we've got to do over time, as I've always said, is that where there are jobs in this country, we need people with the skills developed in this country. Well, sounds reasonable enough, but we'll see if that actually plays out. Okay, and we went over to Ireland. Let's end on a light note, okay, because there are so many dark notes to end on. I could talk about the 11-year-old kid who killed his dad's pregnant girlfriend. Oh, my God. Can you believe that? That happened in Pennsylvania. Wampum, Pennsylvania. 11-year-old boy shot his father's pregnant girlfriend in the back of the head while she was lying in bed at the Western Pennsylvania farmhouse, then got on the school bus and went to school. I mean, I want to say only in America, but it's really not only in America. It's any place where this kind of thing festers. But the thing that really gets me about this story, it's, I mean, an 11-year-old kid with that kind of depraved indifference to life is certainly something to be worried about, and it's certainly a sign that our society is sick. The fact that he has such easy access, and yeah, I know people are going to roll their eyes at this, such easy access to such deadly weapons at the age of 11. How can anybody say that's right? And get this, the shotgun, which belonged to the kid, is designed for children. And such weapons do not have to be registered. Shotgun designed for children. And that, my friends, that is only in America. Okay, but let's end on that light note, please, because we need it. Details of how police in the Irish Republic finally caught up with the country's most reckless driver have emerged, according to the Irish Times. He had been wanted from counties Cork to Cavan, I hope I'm saying that right, after racking up scores of speeding tickets and parking fines. However, each time the serial offender was stopped, he managed to evade justice by giving a different address. But then his cover was blown. It was discovered that the man every member of the Irish police's rank and file had been looking for, a Mr. Praro Jazdi, wasn't exactly the sort of prized villain whose apprehension leads to an officer winning an award. In fact, he wasn't even human. Praro Jazdi is actually the Polish word for driving license. And not the first and last name on the license. Yeah. So apparently every time they stopped somebody who had a Polish license, they basically wrote a ticket to somebody named driver's license, except it was in Polish, so they didn't know that. And as a result, Prawo Jazdy developed a very bad driving reputation. In a bid to avoid similar mistakes being made in future relevant, in the future, relevant guidelines are being amended. And if nothing else is learned from this driving-related debacle, Irish police officers should now know at least two words of Polish. And Prawo Jazdy has presumably become a cult hero among Ireland's largest immigrant population. Yeah, well, it's a fun note to end on, I think. Write to us, otw@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you with news stories or comments or all sorts of other things like that. Continue to listen to the new editions of The Voice of Long Island as they appear every Friday night at midnight. Actually, they're not new. They're 28 years old, but they're coming out 28 years later to the day. And it's fun to listen to them as if they're new. All right. Let's go out with one of my favorite all-time classics with kind of a different twist to it. We'll see you next week on Off the Wall. Good night.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Never Mars or blue sky. Imagine all the people leaving for good day. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion to imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you will join us, and the world will be as one. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger, and brotherhood or man. Imagine all the people sharing all this world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you will join us, and the world will live as one.
Yeah, kids, you're listening to WUSB in Stony Brook.
Hello, I'm Hubert Sumlin, and you listen to the Blue Station on WUSB, Stony Brooks.
That's right. And any of you out there who need to boycott the Post, you know, if you need to do it, you do it. Just like Emmanuel, I've been doing it all my life. So We're hoping for a successful continued boycott of the New York Post. And right now we're going to hear a little something from NASA right here on WUSB Stony Brook.
Sock it, the sock it, the sock, 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 sock it.